These people were wonderful people. They were people who saved my life. They knew they were saving a child, putting their life at risk.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. A couple of weeks ago, we played the stories of three generations of Australian women. Each woman represented a different wave of feminism, building towards what, today, feels like a high tide. In 2017, a group of women came forward to talk about their experiences of sexual violence and harassment. Since then, many women around the world have been speaking out. And we know, if we've been listening, that it's not just movie stars and models that have been touched by sexual violence, harassment, assault. It's regular people, in regular jobs, and it's been happening for a long, long time. But sometimes the situation isn't regular, and the things that people are saying Me Too about come on top of other traumas. Francine Lazarus migrated to Australia after World War II. She repressed memories of sexual assault for decades. When fellow Holocaust survivor Lily Wolfe shared her own story of sexual assault recently, Francine felt brave enough to speak out. For International Women's Day, we have a feature for you, made by producer Lisa Clark. It's a story of women who have been saved with one hand and silenced with the other. This is their time to say, Me Too. Heads up, this story touches on sexual violence.
I had a guy who was supposed to be a saviour of me during the Holocaust who came into bed with me. And when I went and told his wife in the morning that he had weed in my bed, or so I thought, she told me that I was a dirty, filthy, lying Jewess and get out of my house.
In 2017, a group of women came forward to talk about their experiences of sexual violence and harassment. Since then, many women around the world are speaking out, including Holocaust survivors. The experiences of women and children during the Holocaust were often not heard or shared. Some of these women have been holding on to their secrets for years. One of these women is Francine Lazarus. As a 4-year-old Jewish child growing up in Belgium, she had no idea that her whole world was about to be thrown into turmoil. With the outbreak of World War II, she was put into hiding far away from her loved ones in the countryside.
I remember very, very strongly when I was abandoned. My family didn't want me. They left me with strangers on a farm, and I'd never seen pigs and horses and chickens running. I never knew eggs came out of chickens. You know, you learn a lot of things when you're in a farm. But in fact, I wasn't abandoned. I was hidden. I was put into hiding. But in my heart, I was abandoned. I'd been given away. These people were wonderful people. They were people who saved my life. They knew they were saving a child. They were putting their life at risk. They fed me well, they kept me clean, and they kept me safe. And that gave me a basis to survive for the rest of the war. But they didn't show any love or affection. There was no hugs. It's not like your mother takes you in her arms and kisses you goodnight. We had haystacks in the back of the farm. Haystacks, you don't see them anymore because most people have never seen haystacks because they roll up the hay in bales. So if you want to go and have a look at them, you've got to go to the Musée d'Orsay and see paintings. One of the haystacks, I didn't know, was hollow. I wasn't aware. All I know is that I played around the haystacks. It never occurred to me to do anything with it. You know, it just They were there. One day a truck rolled up and out came people screaming, big noise. Men, always men, in uniform, without uniform, all sorts of men hanging around, running around, there screaming. And the next thing I remember, Catherine grabs me and pushes me into the haystack. I didn't know it had been hollowed out. I wouldn't have had a clue. She tucked me in between her legs very, very tightly, and she held me with one hand and the other hand she held my mouth so that I wouldn't scream. And anyway, I was too startled and frightened, and I wouldn't have screamed, but I don't think she took any chance. Through the hay, you could see the men were in the courtyard against the wall. A lot of movement was going and a lot of screaming. And the two men of the farm, the two farmers, who were really resistance people. And then I heard shots and there was blood. There was blood on the wall, there was blood on the peaches, but, you know, I didn't see the men, I couldn't see a lot of noise, a lot of people running in and out. And the next thing I know, the soldiers and the civilians start taking farm implements and they start digging them into the haystack. I'm sure they weren't looking for a little Jewish girl that was hiding there. They were looking, either the men had hidden an airman who had jumped off with a parachute, or ammunition, or they'd blown up some installation and they wanted to find proof, or whatever it was. They weren't looking for me, but somehow the tines of a pitchfork went into the back of my neck. I didn't scream. Catherine held my mouth, and I was lucky because it would have been blood on the tines of the fork. But as they withdrew the hay, cleaned the blood off the tines, and so I was safe. When all the commotion ended, there was blood on the ground, but the men were nowhere to be seen.
Francine never found out what happened to the farmers, but always assumed the worst. After this horrific experience, she was shifted from safe house to safe house, never really finding safety at all.
And I'm afraid of my own shadow sometimes.
For years, her situation became more and more dangerous until the end of the war, when one of her so-called protectors became what she feared the most, a predator.
And I was old enough to realise that what he was doing wasn't right. Old enough to realise that by not taking a stand, I was wrong. I mean, I had a guy who was supposed to be a saviour of me during the Holocaust who came into bed with me. And when I went and told his wife in the morning that he had weed in my bed, or so I thought, she told me that I was a dirty, filthy, lying Jewess, and get out of my house. At the time, I thought nobody's going to believe it. But my brother, they send a message for my brother to come and get me. You know, thrown me out. It was the most dangerous time. It was just a few days before the liberation, before the American tanks rolled in. And she put all my belongings in a cardboard box and put me on the street. And I waited, it seemed to me like hours and hours and hours. And I was so desperate to go to the toilet. And I was on the street there with this cardboard box, and my brother at the risk of his own life, came to pick me up. So I don't know how they got a message to my brother. But it was extremely dangerous to be on the street. And that is where we both were. Sadly, my own experiences were very disorganized and very... I didn't have an education to realize the extent of the way I was treated. And after the war, you know, my grandparents made such a fuss of this man. They never believed me. It's, you see, that's why a lot of women haven't spoken about it. At the time, I didn't want to talk about it also. But I'm not so convinced about the Me Too movement. That is now snowballing, and it's getting out of hand. And I'm worried that people are going to be found telling fibs. It's very, very easy when you've had a grudge against somebody to sort of attach a label. And that's where we've got to be very careful. This rush throughout the world, it seems as though there's nobody who hasn't been attacked by some predator. I should imagine that it's very, very wide, very happening a lot. I got a lot of courage from listening to Lily. And she was abused by the liberators, just like I was abused by the person in charge of hiding and protecting me. She said, they did it to me. I didn't do anything bad. And I'm thinking, what a wonderful attitude.
You're listening to All the Best. This is a story Lisa Clark made about the Me Too movement for a group of Holocaust survivors.
At the time, I wasn't aware of their reputation. The looting and the raping and the raping and the looting. And those three got me into an apartment and the three of them raped me.
Lily Wolfe's memory is still as vivid as it was seven decades ago. In 1944, the Hungarian Jews were forced to live in ghettos. They were forbidden to leave. Inside these ghettos, there was little food and even less medical care for those who were sick. Approximately 25,000 Jewish people from Budapest were transported to Auschwitz. The end of the war was nearing, but the Nazis weren't giving up. More than 70,000 Jews in Budapest were forced to march to the camps in Austria.
We called it a death march. We didn't know where we were going. We called it the death march. Now, in the meantime, on the third day, there was one of the ladies who couldn't walk anymore. So she must have been close to 60 and never been used to walking so much. And she sat then on the side of the highway on the road. And the German went to her and said, you can't stay here, you have to go and with the others. She said, I can't walk anymore, I'm not able to. So he took out his revolver and shot her on the spot. Now, this German has given the rest of the 240 odd people an order, get some paper wherever on the highway flying, and cover the body. I got hungry and I was cold. And what I've done is I tore a piece of paper off the paper which was covered, the dead ones, put them in my hand, put some tea leaves in and made a cigarette out of it. I was very healthy and relatively strong in every respect. In my mind, I have to survive, I have to get through, and so on.
Thousands were shot or died from starvation. As the murdering continued, somehow Lily convinced the Nazis to let her go back to Budapest by saying she wasn't healthy enough to continue on. When she returned, She met a Swedish diplomat who offered to put her into hiding until it was safe enough to escape to Sweden. Along with 24 others, they waited quietly and patiently.
All of a sudden I hear zzzz, explosion. And when I opened up my eyes, I saw white dust, grey concrete dust, and the sky above me. So I was very grateful that I survived it. And I made my way down to the cellar to see what's going on. And you wouldn't believe out of the 24, only 6 people survived it. The bomb went right through. On the 6th, we went to another Swedish protected house, which was closer to the edge of the city where the Russians will come first. And I tell you honestly, I don't know what happened to me, where I slept, where I ate in the next 6 to 8 days, because the Russians arrived on the 14th of January, and that was the 6th of January. I only know that when I saw the first Russians, Messiah came.
The Soviet forces had begun to liberate Hungary from the Nazis, with troops driving out the last German units over the next several months.
There were street fights between the Germans and the Russians. So what happened to me, that I was so happy to see them, and I knew at the time that they're going towards the city and towards the ghetto, so I can see my brother and eventually my grandmother and my auntie. I didn't know what happened to them. I didn't know, are they alive or not? And as they were, the Russians were marching forward, so was I behind them. But there were 3 Russians were on the street, and they caught me. I knew I will be in trouble because one of them I saw, I was crying and I was telling, doctor, doctor, I thought he might understand that I am not healthy enough. And he's got a red penis. It was unbelievable. I had a brother and I know what he's looked like. We grew up together, but that was something else. So after the 3, I got myself together. And there were other groups of people coming and going after the Russians, and I joined them. And eventually we got into the ghetto after 2 days. Again, we slept somewhere on the street, we don't know. I can't remember. And as I went towards the ghetto, opposite me comes my grandmother, my auntie, and her 2-year-old. So we fell in each other's arms. I said, where is my brother? And grandma said, he was with us 36 hours ago. And 1.5 day before evening, my brother went back and something must have happened to him. I caught from the Russian with the red penis gonorrhea. I did tell them, yes, I did. And they were very cautious that I should not have any bath with anybody because it's contagious. Uncle, once he found out we are alive and he knew that grandma and the little one had the diarrhea, so he organized penicillin. At that time, Hungary didn't have any penicillin yet. So he organized the penicillin. By the time it arrived, grandma and the little boy were all right, and the penicillin went into me. And that's how I got rid of my gonorrhea. I didn't have nightmares. I don't have a fear of men or nothing of that kind. It somehow totally is out of my body, mentally, physically.
One of her uncles was in Australia at the time and found out through the Red Cross that his mother, his sister and Lily were still alive. He asked them if they'd want to immigrate to Australia and they said yes. Lily personally just wanted to get as far away from Hungary as she possibly could. Now, at 90 years old, Lily volunteers at the Sydney Jewish Museum, where she shares her story and is often asked to reflect on her experience. Long before the Me Too movement, she knew how important it was to share her story with others.
I am either in the museum or in the Courage to Care, and I tell that story, what you heard from me now, I tell them every time I'm there. So automatically, it is in my mind. I do think of it, but not in a negative way. The girls, usually, if there were girls, they came to me and felt sorry for me and came and cried on my shoulder. So some of them, not all, some of them feel guilty, but mostly feel for me and admire me that I have gone through all that and I'm still here with 90 years of age and tell them the story. And I didn't tell my children until they were in their teens. To the very day, they're very proud of me that I am telling my story to others, to children. They're very proud that I survived it and that I continue fighting for the truth and for the children of the future. But they don't say, oh, poor mom. No, there's no such thing.
Francine now also shares her experience with others at the Sydney Jewish Museum with the hope that sexual violence against women and children will end.
Everybody sort of say, you know, that I must have had a lot of courage and a lot of strength and a lot of resilience. But you go with the flow. It happens to you. You're not aware. First of all, you don't realize that you don't have the same life as everybody else. You just think the way you live is the way everybody lives. My daughter has a very, very strong conviction, but I instilled that into her because when she was little, I always said to her, never, ever, ever be dependent on a man. My family, my daughter, my granddaughter, are very strong. And I have absolutely no fear for them. I know that they'll do well and nobody will take advantage of them. You know, and that makes me very, very proud.
If you're asking your question, which is the crucial thing, like how and why is it human beings did this? I personally feel there's an important question of why is it men do it? Now, women also murder. Women also can become complicit with the act of genocide. And the question of rape and sexual violence is something I've been studying for probably way too long. And I still feel, I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong with my gender.
Lisa also spoke to Dr. Ari Lander from the Sydney Jewish Museum. He's worked alongside survivors for many years. He's also done extensive research on sexual violence against Jewish women during and after the Holocaust. This is what he had to say.
The question of violence when war happens is the conquering of land. It's also the conquering of bodies. And I think that's intimately tied with men conquering the bodies of women. And so I think it's, again, this context of a war of destruction and a process of brutalization and the creation of a culture, even in the short time of it, is of violence being justified and warranted and revenge. In fact, many survivors speak about this process of being silenced or oppressed for many decades in different ways was something that they now feel the shackles have come off. And many survivors have not felt the shackles have come off the issue of sexual oppression. That there are women academics and survivors who go out and speak to females, and the last thing they can admit on their deathbed is, I was raped and I could never tell anyone. We have not that many testimonies that speak about the issue of sexual violence, but it's in its thousands. It's a hugely significant part of this history, and knowing that there are many female survivors who come at the end of their lives and suddenly like, I wish I'd been able to talk about this. I feel being in a space like this is that you need to. So this is a hugely significant aspect of this story in terms of this sexual violence enacted on Jewish women.
That story was produced by Lisa Clark, with special thanks to Rebecca Kummerfeld and Dr. Ari Lander from the Sydney Jewish Museum, and Ben Tupas for his original music. Beth Gibson was the supervising producer, and thanks to Hannah Riesch for her consulting producing. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, and it's her last week on the show, so we're going to miss her very much. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. And I'm your host, Samantha Groth. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter, and all our other episodes are at allthebestradio.com. We'd love you to subscribe to All the Best on your favourite podcast app.